Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book called Inside Bordeaux, The Chateaus, Their Wines, and the Terroir by Jane Anson. Is it possible to write something new on a region that has been so widely covered, studied, dissected, discarded, rediscovered, fought over, loved, despised, rinse and repeat? Yes. I was quoting from the first line in the introduction to this book, but I actually, the last comment there, the affirmative, that was me. This episode is brought to you by the Psalm TV merchandise store. You can find it at shop.psalmtv.com. And it's basically a destination for all things Psalm. We've got everything from coffee mugs, you can put your wine in there too, to decorative pillows, to rosé all summer beach towels. Everything you need at shop.psalmtv.com. So this book is back to the brand new books that were published in 2020. So this just came out. And disclaimer, this is by far the largest and longest book that I have read and reviewed for this podcast. It is 670 pages, including an index. And I don't know how much it weighs, but it would certainly serve as a doorstop if you weren't busy reading and referencing it. So this book is written by a woman named Jane Anson. And we need to give her a little bit of background because she is extraordinarily accomplished. This is not her first book. So Jane Anson is the Bordeaux correspondent for Decanter, and she has lived in the region of Bordeaux since 2003. She has published multiple books, largely on Bordeaux. At glance, it looks like, I don't know, 7 or 8 books previous to this one. But she's also a columnist. She writes a column for the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong. She used to live in Hong Kong. She writes a weekly column for Decanter China. She is an accredited teacher at the Bordeaux École du Vin, the wine school in Bordeaux. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. And she has a master's in publishing from University College in London. And I wanted to say this in French. She has a diplôme universitaire d'aptitude à la dégustation des vins from the Bordeaux Faculty of Enology. So she has basically a diploma in tasting the wines of Bordeaux. She's legit. And this book, in addition to all of those other accolades and accomplishments, she, I believe this book was nominated for the Louis Roederer International Wine Writers Awards. I think it was one of those best books of 2020 nominees. But in addition to that, she won the Louis Roederer Award for like online wine columnist or something like that. So she is incredibly accomplished in her field. And when I was doing a little bit of research on Jane, one of the things that I started, because we're on a first name basis, never have met her, but I shall call her by her first name. One of the things that struck me is the similarity in her expertise to this region as that of another author from a previously reviewed book, Peter Leem and Champagne. And I think there's a lot of parallels, not between the styles of wine, but just in their level of expertise and knowledge, but also the fact that they live there. And, you know, if Peter Leem is considered, you know, one of the Champenois, then I think that Jane Anson is probably considered one of the Bordelais. So this book, you know, what she says in the beginning, it's so true. Bordeaux is, you know, it's thought of as a blue chip region. It's one of the first regions that you learn about. It's some of the most highly coveted, ageable, collectible wines. And we'll kind of talk about why that is. And it's been classified and ranked, and the producers have been assigned scores and status and symbols. And so it really has been dissected and studied and covered. And I have multiple books about Bordeaux in my own personal library. And this one, it's next level. She intends this book to be, in the dedication, I think it's quite charming. She intends this book to be for all those at both the beginning and the end of this process, whether you're making the wine or pulling the corks. And I really like that because this, to be fair, this is a reference text. It reads really, you know, very well. It's an interesting book. And I should say that it's very visually appealing. It has lots and lots of photographs from Bordeaux of the vineyards, of the chateaus, but it also has lots of maps. And I love maps. So this book was ingratiating itself into my heart like early on. So in terms of how this book is organized, it's very thoughtful. It starts off with a background to Bordeaux, starting from, you know, the Roman times. And then, you know, the first 100 pages or so cover the grapes, the proportion of grapes, information about them, climate change, winemaking, viticulture. And then the real meat of this book is, I mean, like 500 pages of this book are the appellations and the wines. And she breaks them into categories. And then does an overview of the region, and then over 800 chateaus are mentioned in this book. And chateau is the French word for castle, and that's the term we often use for the wineries in Bordeaux. Not every winery actually has a chateau, but there are a lot of them, and some of them are quite famous. So we just call the wineries in Bordeaux, kind of colloquially, we call them chateaus. And one thing that's really interesting to note is that she didn't employ like a team of researchers. She personally visited, tasted, and researched the wines and these producers, all nearly 800 of them. So legwork, it's been done. So one of the things that a book like this, I think one of the risks that it runs is that, of course, the wine world changes, right? There's always, you know, new things happening, and it is easier or swifter for a book to go out of date than an online resource. But since this book came out in 2020, it does a remarkable job of addressing some very recent updates and potential changes in the Bordeaux region. So sure, things will change in the world, but this is a fairly established region. And so I think change is maybe not as rapid here as it might be in other places. And the other thing that I think is so interesting about this book, in addition to being so up-to-date and so authoritative and so visually appealing, is that the focus on this book is all about, well, it's very encompassing, but one of the big focuses is about the idea of terroir. So terroir is this notion that all of the natural influences and elements about where a grape is grown contribute to its quality and style. So, you know, the soil, the climate, the microclimate, not just the climate of the region, but the climate in the vineyard and the climate in the canopy of the grapevine, the methods of viticulture, the methods of vinification, because human influence has an impact on terroir. And oftentimes, I think Bordeaux, and I'm not alone in this opinion, but I think many people just think of Bordeaux as kind of stodgy and old school and stiff and old fashioned. And it's all about the rankings, because Bordeaux has a series of very well-known, very established rankings of the chateaus. But she actually makes the argument that now more than ever before, there has been a renewed focus on the idea that, one, there's been an evolution of style in the wines of Bordeaux. And this has to do with not just the changing of the climate, but the vastly complicated range of soil types and the microclimates, the terroir, that are being taken more seriously than ever in Bordeaux. And so this gives us a really, you know, kind of a focus on that. So there's a whole section detailing the geology, the different types of soil, and throughout the exploration of the different chateaus, not for everyone, but for some of the most famous, there will be side-by-side maps of vineyard holdings and vineyard property with what grapes they're planted to. And then right next to that will be a map, the exact same map with the different soil types. And so there's a constant linking of what's planted where based on what is, you know, what the soil type is. And I don't know if that's the approach that has been taken for a long time. So it's very cool, I think, to see it here. Anyway, let's start at the beginning of this very, very large book. And one of the first things that she tackles, of course, is the history of Bordeaux. And when I say history, like starting off with the Celts and the Romans, and then the church and the Middle Ages, and then the arrival of the English and the Dutch. And look, there's so much in this book. I can't go through all of it. I have to pick out snippets. I mean, like I said, it's nearly 700 pages. But there was something that as I was starting to read this book and starting to read this chapter on the history of Bordeaux, honestly, I was kind of wondering if it would be included. So it's 20 pages in the history of Bordeaux, and it talks about Bordeaux and the triangular trade. And what that refers to is essentially in the late 17th century, the Dutch had already kind of established themselves in Bordeaux. And let's do a little bit of background here. Bordeaux is on the western coast of France, kind of southwestern. It's on the Atlantic coast. And it has, if you're not familiar or haven't seen a map, it has what we call a distinctly maritime climate. It is influenced by its proximity to the ocean. But Bordeaux is also very unique in that there's a large estuary, the Gironde estuary. So it's tidal water that comes inland. And then that estuary is formed by the convergence of two rivers, the Dordogne and the Garonne. And so proximity to these bodies of water influences the climate. And hundreds of years ago, large parts of the area, the land area in Bordeaux was marshy. It was underwater. And Dutch engineers came, they drained it out, exposing lots of gravel beds, among many other soil types, and it became more suitable for viticulture. It also transitioned from more white wine production to more red wine production. There's a long history. This is well known, and you could find this anywhere. But because it's located right on the coast, the port of Bordeaux is a major shipping city. And essentially, this idea of triangular trade was that the Minister of Finance under Louis XIV, Louis XIV, they established this, the building of the first French ship in Bordelais shipyards. Essentially, what happened is that they realized that the Bordelais were, and larger aspects of the, you know, French shipping and the French industry was reliant on Dutch ships to export their wine and other goods instead of running things themselves. And so they decided to build their own ships. And so this shipping route that, and I should preface this by saying this is what I'm about to discuss, I don't think has been discussed in any other books about Bordeaux that I can think of in recent memory. So French ships are being built so they can not rely on Dutch ships for trade. And the triangular trade that is referenced is that the ships would leave, you know, the port of Bordeaux or Europe generally, and they would ride the prevailing winds down to Africa. And then they would, quote unquote, you know, pick up goods. That's how it's described in many other texts. And then they would travel, the middle leg of the voyage would be to exploit the trade winds to the West Indies and to North America. And then the third leg of the triangle would be to take kind of a more northerly Atlantic route back to Europe. And the first known triangular voyage went from Bordeaux to the West Indies, then to Quebec in 1672. Vast fortunes were built and created, and this was an unparalleled source of financial like boom, unparalleled in France except for Paris. And this really heralded the golden age of Bordeaux and built fortunes. And what is not discussed is that the goods that were being picked up in Africa, it was slave trade. Ships were sailing from France to Africa to steal humans and enslave them and take them to the West Indies and North America. And that is something that has really kind of, I think there's an increased need and call to talk about this kind of stuff, because put it into some perspective, this was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But if we think about what's happened in the past year, with all of the social unrest and the racial inequities and everything that kind of really came to a head in the summer of 2020, we've talked about this and it's far from being beaten to death, but one of the things that kind of came out with that directly affects, you know, people who love wine is the fact that the wine industry is not a very diverse industry. You know, the Court of Master Sommeliers got heat for not responding to calls to denounce racial injustice and support Black Lives Matters. When we talk about wine and we talk about wines from these, you know, famous and established places for too long, many people just simply aren't taught about the full spectrum of the history. Now, this is one aspect of the history of this region, but it's an important foundational aspect. And so as I was starting to read this book, I was wondering, wow, is she going to talk about that? Is she going to talk about the slave trade in Bordeaux? And she did. And so this book came out in 2020, which means it was being worked on prior to that. So it's not reactionary. It's just part of the, you know, whole story of what this region is. Now, she doesn't just talk about the triangular trade. She does talk a little bit more. I mean, even in 1777, there was a census of the general Bordeaux area. And included in that census were, you know, listed in the vernacular of the day, Black slaves, men and women, also free Black people, and, you know, what their vocations were, whether they were, you know, innkeepers or soldiers or seamstresses. And so it is talked about, but she says specifically that she'd like to see more chateaus talk about their role in this period of Bordeaux's history. And to that I say, yeah, I'd like to hear more about it too, because it's just something that has been, frankly, whitewashed and not talked about. So I was encouraged to see that included in, it's a very important part of the history of the region, and I'm really glad that it's included in this book. So I mentioned one of the things about, you know, a book, it can go out of date really quickly. And one of the newest things for this very established region that happened, you know, this year, it's been talked about for a while, is that it has been approved for new grape varieties, been approved by the INAO. This is a French organization that kind of supervises and oversees the appellation d'origine contrôlée, the appellations in France for wine production. And this is the approval of new varieties is taking effect as of the 2021 vintage. The grapes won't be listed on the label, but typically the grapes are not listed on the label in any French wine regions, save for Alsace. And they're not necessarily going to be in all wines. This is just they're approved for use. And the idea is that as the climate changes, eventually some of the grape varieties that have historically been planted in this region, you know, they'll no longer be able to be grown and make good wine. The conditions will not be suitable for them. And so it's a very forward-thinking idea that, you know, we need to look at this. We know climate change is real. What might work here and why, given the soil, given the environment, given the, you know, the potential change for the climate. And there was a list of varieties that were potentially going to be approved, four different red grapes, and Jane includes three white grapes. And as it turns out, all four of the red grapes were approved for experimental use in Bordeaux, and two of the three white grapes that she mentioned. So, like, this book is on it in terms of current events. And I don't anticipate that there will be more grape varieties approved for use anytime soon. This is a big step. And I mean, the grapes are things that are probably unfamiliar to a lot of producers. For red grapes, it's Arinoa, which is a cross of Tanat and Cabernet Sauvignon. Marcellon, which is a Cabernet Sauvignon and Grenache cross. Castets, which is an old, like an ancient rare variety that was previously grown in the Gironde, in the Bordelais area. And Tariga Nacional, which is best known for being grown in Portugal. And then for white varieties, Alvarinho, which is the same grape as Albarinho. It's planted in all across Galicia, so northwestern Spain. It's the grape of Rias Baixas. It's called Albarinho in Spain, but Alvarinho in Portugal. And then Liliorria, I think I'm saying that right. It's a cross of Baroque and Chardonnay. It's probably the least well-known of all of the suggested varieties. And so there's some interesting choices. She does include one of the possibilities, which is Petite Mansang, which she says is the most interesting of the three allowable whites. It was not approved, but it was potentially. And it's most well-known for being planted in the Jurançon region of southwestern France, so south and west of where Bordeaux is located, which is kind of southwest. And it has kind of some aromatic complexity. And what's interesting is that Petite Mansang and Gros Mansang, these are sort of two of the major grapes of this area. And I just have to chuckle because they are certainly notable for the wines of this area, southwest France. But I have to give a shout out to a former colleague of mine, Kellen Monroe, when he was explaining one of, you know, a wine at Alinea that was, you know, he was explaining at tableside that was made of these grapes. And I believe, as it was told to me, Kellen explained it and said, you know, this wine is made of Gros Mansang, Petite Mansang. You know what I'm saying? I just died because he's a funny guy. And you know what? Wine is fun. So I had to give a shout out to Kellen. Anyway, so from the history and sort of the grapes, you know, Jane touches on winemaking and the art of the blend, viticulture, vinification. A lot of this stuff would be topics that, you know, a wine lover and certainly anyone who's, you know, kind of a wine scholar would be familiar with. She does talk about second wines. And this is a really interesting concept in Bordeaux. So, you know, most of the wines that consumers are familiar with are what we would consider the grand vin, the big wine of the estate or the chateau. But oftentimes they, you know, have more grapes than would go into that grand vin. And so second wines, additional fruit that they own and can vinify, they can put a second wine or even a third wine out. And so she talks about that. She discusses the Bordelais sales system, and it's a three-tier system, and it's not the three-tier system that we talk about for beverage alcohol in the United States. It's not importer, distributor, retailer. What it is Chateau Courtier Négociant, and it's a very unique Bordelais system. And that term négociant, it gets used in other regions in other ways. And so one thing that's really important, and she does a very good job explaining it, you got to get the book and read it for yourself, is that if you've heard of a négociant in Burgundy, it's not really the same deal as a négociant in Bordeaux. And so there's just different roles. The whole marketing and commercialization history of Bordeaux is very unique to Bordeaux. And she explains it very, very thoroughly and very well. She also tackles the unpremier system, which is another uniquely Bordelais concept, which is the idea of essentially it's a yearly betting on the wines. It's wine futures. So journalists and critics and buyers will give their prognosis on, you know, the most recent vintage, and chateaus will set their prices based on this prognosis. And if you bet, this is before the wines are even released. If you bet that the wines will be really good and you're willing to you know, put your money where your mouth is, you could actually score a really great deal because you're betting that the wine once released will be as good as you think it will be. So you buy your futures, you know, early. Doesn't always happen. But she talks about that system because that's a very uniquely Bordelaise system. And then also about, you know, in 2012, the very famous exodus of Chateau Latour, a first growth Bordeaux producer, when they decided they would no longer be a part of the Unpermer system. So there's all kinds of like cool, like history anecdotes. And then she tackles probably what Bordeaux is most well known for, which is the classifications. So the soil types and the different grape varieties and how they're planted, that's the focus of this book. But what many people associate with Bordeaux are the classifications. And the big one is the 1855 classification. This is the idea that in preparation for the World's Fair, 60 estates, now 61 because there was an addition, were ranked according to their quality and the price that they were fetching at the time. And it was just a ranking of wines of the Médoc and Graves. Well, only one wine from Graves was included, but this is the left bank of Bordeaux. So we have this big estuary and these rivers that form a fork coming in from the Atlantic coast. These are all of, you know, the producers that were ranked are all on sort of the left side of that river. We call that the left bank. And they were broken down into five tiers, first growth being the top, then second, third, fourth, and fifth growth. But that's not the only classification in Bordeaux. It has remained largely unchanged. And I mean, there are arguments to be made that maybe not everyone is like up to snuff, but the price that the wines fetch is, there's a very strong correlation to what their ranking is. So it is important. It has definitely lasted through the times. There have been attempts to rewrite it. They have never succeeded, but it is as ironclad as a ranking, I guess, could be. It's pretty interesting stuff, but it's not the only ranking or classification system in Bordeaux. It is important to know that it was purely based on the reputation and price of those producers at the time. But there have been subsequent rankings of the sweet white wines of Sauternes and Barsac, a classification of the wines purely of the region of Graves, which is sort of the southeastern part of the left bank, a classification of Saint-Emilion, which is a region on the right bank across the river. And the categories and the stipulations for those rankings are different. And she talks about all of those. And then outside of the big players, those that are ranked the Saint-Emilion and the 1855 classification, there are also some additional classifications for Cru Bourgeois and Cru Artisan. And these are for smaller producers. They have different requirements and they have many, many, many more producers. And so she explains all of those. And it's important to understand, it's not the focus of this book, but it's important to understand the region, what these classifications imply. So this 1855 classification, it awarded its rank to the estates, not specific plots of land. And this is one of the things that really distinguishes like Bordeaux from Burgundy, where if you think about Burgundy, individual vineyards are ranked. You have Grand Cru vineyards or Premier Cru vineyards, and a producer might own the entire vineyard, or they might own parcels within the vineyard or just rows, but it's not the producer who has the ranking. It's the plot of land. In Bordeaux, it's the producer. And so one thing that's really interesting about that is that these chateaus, because they're the ones that are ranked, they have been able to change the size and the shape of their vineyards within their appellation without sacrificing status. They've been able to accumulate more land or sell off more land. So it's not true for everyone. Some have maintained very consistent size and ownership throughout the years, but some have changed drastically. And so it's an interesting difference and it's important to understand. Now, despite those caveats, Bordeaux chateaus must source their grapes from their own vineyards. So they have a négociant, but it's not part of the négociant system like we might see in Burgundy, where a négociant might purchase in grapes from land they don't own. That's not a thing in Bordeaux. The négociant has a different role. But Bordeaux chateaus, they're only sourcing grapes from land that they actually own and control. So it's a very different environment. But the first 100 pages really kind of lay out this explanation and really explain an area just so, so well. And I mean, it reads like a novel. It's the technical stuff. It's the history. It's the background, but it's not boring. It's not like funny or anything like that, but it's so well explained and so clear that I thought it was fascinating. So while Jane tackles kind of the basics of viticulture, density of planting, clones, irrigation, pruning, there's a really interesting little tidbit. And I found this throughout this entire book, just little bits of information that I'd never seen anywhere else before that I was like, oh, that's so cool. And it comes under the discussion of rootstocks. So if we back up a little bit, and this is very cleverly kind of snuck in there in the history of Bordeaux. You know, I mentioned that Jane starts with, you know, talking about the Celts and the Romans, and then it moves all the way up to modern times. And there is a section about the American influence in Bordeaux, and it incorporates everything from, you know, the first minister of France, Thomas Jefferson, spending time in Bordeaux, writing up, by the way, prior to the 1855 classification. He wrote up and included in his writings three of what are now first growth as the best wines of the Médoc, but they had not yet been classified. So I guess TJ had some good taste for sure. But even Robert Parker, the influential American wine critic who rose to fame predicting the greatness of the 1982 vintage in Bordeaux, even he makes an appearance in this history of Bordeaux. But one thing that's so, I mean, I guess this is as close to like some humor that we get is America has had a permanent role in Bordeaux ever since Fenwick's time. Fenwick refers to an ambassador or first American consul in Bordeaux who was appointed in 1790. So ever since then, Americans have had a presence in Bordeaux, but Jane says not just becoming a dominant export market, but also the source of the Phylloxera vastatrix insect that devastated the vineyards of France in the second half of the 19th century. So most kind of wine connoisseurs are familiar with this idea, but Phylloxera is a root louse. It's an aphid that is native to the eastern United States. All of the vines that we are talking about and all of the vines that make fine wine all over the world are European vines, species Vitis vinifera. And this bug inadvertently got transported, probably on some cuttings, on some plant cuttings, to Europe in the 1800s. And European vines were not resistant to this bug, and it lives in the soil and it eats away and it creates sores on the roots of the plant. And eventually the health of the plant declines and eventually it dies. It was a disaster. It affected vineyards all over the world. And ultimately the solution to that was grafting onto rootstock. So this is the idea that you have the root part of the plant and what comes just out of the ground is a species, an American species that's resistant to this American bug. And then you can graft onto that, like putting one Lego on top of another, whatever kind of grapevine you want to grow. We call that part the scion. So you have your various American rootstock, you plant that, but then you can graft on your Pinot Noir, your Cabernet Sauvignon, you know, your Nebbiolo, whatever it is. So she talks about rootstocks in Bordeaux, and invariably, you know, there are some examples of ungrafted vines depending on your soil type. Phylloxera doesn't thrive in sandy soils, and there's pockets of sand in Bordeaux. So almost all vines are grafted onto American rootstock. But here's the interesting thing. She lists the types, and unless you're a viticulturist, the actual names of the rootstocks probably won't mean anything to you. But she says, only one estate that I know of in Bordeaux grows its own American vines purely for their rootstock and has on an isolated island in the Garonne River for the purpose. That estate is Chateau Smithot-Lafitte in Pessac-Lannion. How cool is that? That's so cool. Now, it's these islands in the river, they you can't grow grapes on them and have them be part of the appellation. The conditions are different. And so, I mean, I love the wines of Chateau Smithot-Lafitte. And it's so cool that they actually, you know, on this island that you, in the river, because these are big rivers, you couldn't grow grapes and use them in your grand vin for like, because they're not entitled to the appellation status. So they're growing American vines so they can use the rootstock. I mean, we talk about producers in Bordeaux having their own cooperage, making their own barrels to keep everything close to home, but that's legit. Growing your own American vines for rootstock, I thought that was so incredible. Anyway, wanted to make sure that I included that little bit of information. I also, look, I love maps. I draw maps. And one of the things that's so interesting and so clear throughout this book are all of the interesting maps that are included, particularly of the different soils. And there is a fair amount of geology, which doesn't always make for the most interesting reading, but it's really key to understanding the different soil types. And the maps help someone like me, who's much more of a visual learner, kind of match up what I'm seeing and what I'm reading to kind of the bigger picture. Then you got to put all this information together. So like I mentioned, she spends like the first 100 pages laying this all out. And then we kind of work into a section where she tackles all of these kind of section or all of these regions one by one. So she breaks the whole region of Bordeaux up into these larger subsections, the northern left bank, the southern left bank, the right bank, what we call the Entre de Mer, which is in between the two seas or in between the two rivers, the Garonne and the Dordogne, that converge to form the Gironde estuary. And within these, she will then tackle the individual appellations. So for example, I will not and cannot go through all of them. But for example, when we start on the lower left bank, she starts off with the AOC, the appellation of Margaux, commune of Margaux. And there's a pattern that's repeated for all of these different communes is she gives a lot of facts. What the size is in hectares. A hectare is like 2.7 acres, but that's the land unit measure that we use in Europe. And she also puts it in perspective that Margaux, the appellation, is about 9% of the total Médoc vineyard area. She lists the communes, the actual, you know, the names of the towns that are within the appellation, the classifications that producers within Margaux enjoy. In this case, there are producers who are part of the 1855 classification, and also the Cru Bourgeois. She includes the average annual production for that appellation, how many different producers or winemakers there are, the average size of the estate, key terroir styles and types, key appellation rules, the grape varieties and the proportions they're planted, interesting viticulture notes, you know, what proportion of vineyards are farmed organically or biodynamically, because that's on the rise in Bordeaux. And then interesting developments and Bordeaux and producers to watch. And then she tackles producers by producers. So for example, in Margaux, she starts off with first growth, Chateau Margaux. This is one of the five best of the best producers, according to the 1855 classification. Now, here's one thing that I really love. With all of these producers, for any producer that is classified, whether it's 1855 or Saint-Emilion or whatever, she lists how it's classified according to that ranking. And then the next line is the JA rating, the Jane Anson rating. And she's clearly an authority on Bordeaux. And oftentimes, her rating of the producer of the chateau corresponds to what classification has been given, but not always. And there's some real key interesting divergences where she thinks a producer, based on her extensive tasting visits and research, probably deserves a higher ranking, or when maybe it deserves a lower ranking. And so it just kind of goes to show that while this is quote unquote carved in stone, some of these classifications, they're not really. And, you know, it's just a guideline and a framework. But she will include history on, you know, who the owners of the chateau are, sometimes some interesting family, you know, tidbits, what proportion of red wine and white wine, of first wine, of second wine that they make, just a great overview. It's really thoroughly done. And once she works through all of, for example, the 1855 classifications, then she will include any additional classifications, any Cru Bourgeois or Cru Artisan producers. Like I said, this book covers nearly 800 chateaus. So it's not maybe exhaustive, but it's as close to exhaustive as one can get. Not every producer enjoys this, but some of the more, probably the ones she likes the best and some of the more famous, also include vineyard maps. And sometimes those vineyard maps include, you know, grape varieties and what plots they're planted in, and then also a soil map and what types of soil they're planted on. It's really interesting stuff. Now, as we move along, sometimes there's, as I mentioned, her rating differs from a rating that a producer has been given. So from Margaux, we move to Saint-Julien, and she talks about Chateau Léoville-Lascasse, which is a second growth according to 1855. But Jane, she feels it deserves first growth status, and she goes on to justify it. So, you know, that's one thing that's kind of, it was very cool for me as I was going through these different producers to see how she wrote it up and then, you know, what her thoughts on it are. There are lots of producers who are unranked. And while we are in Saint-Julien, you know, she talks about Chateau Gloria, which is an unranked producer, but how she feels that it's worthy of at least fifth growth on the 1855 scale. And then she talks about a producer I love, Domaine du Jaugeray. And this is an unranked producer. And a while back, I reviewed a book by Neil Rosenthal, and I believe this is a wine that he imports. I'm pretty sure that's how I got to taste it, and I had it on a list. But, you know, it's a real kind of independent style producer, very small, kind of scary because the proprietor doesn't have any children who want to take over the estate, and he's getting on in years. And so this is a story that, you know, Neil Rosenthal talked about in his book, but this is really very much an individualist. I mean, this guy does kind of his own thing to the point that he hasn't always been able to put the name of the appellation on his label. If you don't dot your I's and cross your T's according to the cahier de charge, the rules of the appellation, then you can't put the name of the appellation on your label. And most producers want to do that because they want to take advantage of the familiarity and the knowledge of the appellation, but some independent thinkers will just do what they want to do. But there was a really cool little note in here, and it kind of reminded me of a little story of when I went to Bordeaux a couple of years ago. And Jane Anson describes the cellar at Domaine de Jaugeray as astonishing, like stepping back 100 years with a vertical press and a single large oak cask for vinification. The egg white fining is courtesy of his own hens. So one of the kind of techniques employed in winemaking is something called fining. And fining is a way to remove things and stuff that you don't want in a wine. It could be proteins, it could be tannins, it could be color. And winemakers can add something to the wine, and whatever they add binds with whatever wants to be removed. It could be the protein or the tannin. And then it essentially settles out of solution. So one of the common methods of fining is to use egg whites. And the egg whites will bind with whatever wants to be the winemaker wants to remove. And then it just settles to the bottom. And look, you know, for anyone who wants to get all up in arms about vegan wines, the egg whites don't remain in the wine. They settle out. They're strained out. They become like a solid almost. And you take out what you don't want. But eggs are improved. But don't even get me started on the vegan train, because chicken's going to lay eggs no matter what you do, no matter how nice to them you are, how mean to them you are, they're going to lay eggs. And so the egg whites are used for fining. So the wines of Bordeaux are frequently fined. And so there's a glut of egg yolks, which brings me to my funny little story. So if you've ever been to Bordeaux, or you just enjoy French pastry, there is a unique little pastry called a cannelée. Specifically, I'm referring to a cannelée de Bordeaux. And they're not large. They're like a very large bite. So maybe like an inch and a half tall, inch wide. And the traditional mold looks like a mini bundt pan, but there's not a hole in the middle, just a divot. And classically, they're little copper individual molds. I have never made a cannelée because it looks like it's so labor intensive. I just don't even want a part of it, but I have enjoyed many. In fact, if you find yourself in Bordeaux, you can't get away from them. They are served to you after lunch or dinner with your coffee. Like they're everywhere. And they have this wonderful, like caramelized kind of crackly outside, and then this very custardy inside. And sometimes they're flavored with rum. They're delicious. I highly recommend. But one of the things, at least this was told to me when I went to Bordeaux, is one of the reasons it's such a thing, a cannelée de Bordeaux, is that winemakers were using all of these egg whites to fine their wines, to clarify their wines, and they had all these egg yolks left over. So the recipe for a cannelée, I won't repeat it here, but you can look it up, and it calls for eggs, but it also calls for additional egg yolks. So I don't know what came first, the pastry or the egg, but regardless, one thing that's really cool is that, you know, they're using kind of what they have on hand to both produce their wine, and then nothing goes to waste, and they use all those extra egg yolks to use in cannelées, among other things. So it's kind of a cool story, and I love hearing about a winemaker who finds his wines with his own eggs. So as I said, like the middle 500 pages of this book, it's all exploration of different chateaus, and they all follow the same sort of template. You know, their size, their production, their proportions of their plantings, the styles of wines, Jane's rating, and all of that. And it's so incredibly helpful. I'm not saying you necessarily even need to read every single one of them, but this would be the point where you would go back and reference, or you know, someone presents a wine to you that you're not familiar with, you could go look it up. This is a reference text. Now, the last section of the book, it's the reference section. And it has what a lot of books like this have. It has a glossary, because there's a lot of technical information in here. And so, you know, there's a glossary of terms. And then there's some like pure gold. She has a vintage chart. Are you listening, Eric Asimov? She has a vintage chart from 1855 through 2019. And look, I know some people think that vintage charts are oversimplifying and they are not useful and you shouldn't rely on them, but they're helpful. And some of these are just like a line or two. 1874, harvest started on September 14th and was considered by and large very good quality. Look, I don't think that many people are out to find or could find a bottle of wine from Bordeaux from 1874. And the point is very clearly made that there is a huge variety of soils and microclimates, but the climate of Bordeaux does vary. It is a region that enjoys tremendous amounts of vintage variation. So even if it's overly generalized, it can be helpful to know some information about varying vintages. And so the fact that she's got notes from 1855 onwards is incredible. Now, as you get to the new millennium from 2000 onward, there's much more information because, of course, it's much easier to get. The wines are still around, easily drinkable, but that's a pretty comprehensive vintage chart. She doesn't attach ratings or stars. It's purely descriptive, and I'm here for it. There's a timeline of Bordeaux. It starts in 56 BC and goes all the way through 2009. And then there's a cool part in here talking about drinking Bordeaux wine and when to open it. And this is a thing that is important to discuss. I think many people might not even notice it if this book didn't include this, but Bordeaux wines oftentimes have the ability to age and improve with age for years, if not decades. I'm talking specifically about, you know, the red wines, but the same can be said for the whites and the sweets, is that there are attributes of wines that allow them to improve with age. And in very broad strokes, those attributes are elevated levels of sugar, elevated levels of acidity, elevated levels of tannin. And sometimes you can have a combination of those things, the sugar and the acid for the sweet whites, and the tannin and the acid for the reds. And if you have, you know, healthy fruit and complex flavors and those structural elements, your wine might not just improve in bottle, but improve for decades. But because, particularly with the red wines, they are thick-skinned grapes, over time, the anthocyanins, the colors in the wine and the tannins will polymerize. They will clump together and form big compounds, and they will eventually settle out of solution. And that forms what looks like wine-colored sediment in the bottle. It will not hurt you, but it's a little bit like drinking coffee grounds. And so the tradition for mature red wine, if it quote unquote froze sediment, if this deposit happens over time, is to decant it. And so she talks about decanting Bordeaux, and she talks about, you know, roughly when to open the wine, because some wine is meant to be consumed right away. And some wine, a lot of wine in Bordeaux is, but some definitely can age. She talks about faults that are often encountered in Bordeaux. And then she does list out the classifications and all of the producers who are entitled to those very diverse different classifications. There's a list of the estate sizes from 1855 and today. So with that idea that a producer can only make wine from vineyard property they own, it's interesting to see how those estate sizes have changed, who's changed and who hasn't. She lists all of the communes in all of the appellations, which is insane. I'm not entirely sure what you might need that information for, unless it's for some sort of trivia. And then lastly, an underused kind of section of books, there's a gazetteer. So if, you know, with all of these maps and all of these photos, for any producer who might be indicated on one, because there are such beautiful photos in this book, you can find out, you know, you can just cross-reference what producer was mentioned or photographed where. So what works in this book? Everything. It's so good. This book, I love the wines of Bordeaux. I know that sometimes people, you know, dismiss them as like stodgy and old-fashioned, but you know what? Maybe it's just because I've had very privileged opportunities to taste some very fine examples of these wines, and I have great memories around those times tasting them. But I love the idea, you know, that wines can improve, and I think it's a great way to time travel. And I love the wines. I don't, you know, I'm not a 75-year-old, you know, stodgy collector, but I love these wines. I think they're hip and they're cool. And I think that Bordeaux is a neat area. It was when I went there and did take some, as part of our trip, we took classes every morning at the École du Vin in Bordeaux and then visited producers every afternoon. And our teacher mentioned specifically one of the things he thought made Bordeaux such a cool area. And he said it has a river and a university. So aside from all the wine, it is just it's a cool spot. And so I have an affection for these wines, but this book, it is beautifully written. It's beautifully presented. It's spectacular. In terms of things that don't work, nothing. It's just amazing. It is focused. It's on point. It is basically exhaustive. I mean, she's not like cracking jokes or anything like that. So like, I'm not going to fault her for not being funny. But I learned new things. And I think that the comprehensive aspect of this book is a triumph. So if you weren't surprised, my rating is buy this. Now, I will reinforce this one point. If you are just a casual hobbyist and you're not really trying to like learn and don't care about looking up details, I mean, maybe this book is not for you. It would look very nice on your bookshelf because it is such a substantial volume. You know, it's huge. It's, you know, it's a big book. That's me dropping it on my desk. But for anyone who has any kind of like scholarly aspirations as a sommelier, as a buyer, as a director just wants to be a little bit more informed. If you're interested in buying wine at auction, there's always Bordeaux at auction. I think this is a must have. It's a really, you know, I don't think I could give it a stronger endorsement. It's a really, really, really good book. Whew. All right. Thanks for listening to my diatribe on Bordeaux. I hope that you enjoyed it. And I hope that if you like what you hear, by all means, subscribe, download, and leave us a rating. See you next time. This episode was sponsored by the Somme TV merchandise store. The Somme TV store has all kinds of wine-related merchandise, everything from beach towels to hoodies, depending on where you're living and what you're drinking. You can find it at shop.sommetv.com.